Today on the Scott Radley Show on 900 CHML.
Friday, we do something a little different on the show than all the other nights of the week. We have a guest who comes in and we talk about all kinds of things that have happened in the world over the past 7 days. And today I am thrilled to have this person along. I have known her for a long time. We go back to working at The Spectator, and then that was when she was already winning national newspaper awards and being nominated for them. She is great at journalism. And then she went off into a bunch of other things and is now the associate publisher and editorial director of Hamilton City Magazine. Her name is Meredith McLeod. How are you?
I'm very well, Scott. How are you?
I am terrific. Thanks for doing this. As I say, I've been wanting to have you on here for a long time, and we finally made it happen. So this is good. And it's always good to have someone on here who has won these kinds of awards to balance off those of us who haven't. So that's, we can now say it's an award-winning program today because one of us has done that.
I've only won one, just to be fair. Only won one.
Well, how many times nominated?
Three.
Yeah. Okay. And for people who don't know what the national newspapers, the NNAs are, they are Canada's equivalent of a Pulitzer Prize. So that gives you some indication that Meredith is a star at this whole thing. I still strive for that someday, but I anticipate going to my grave NNA-less.
It will be an injustice if that happens, Scott.
Uh-huh. Well, you keep telling them that, and I will keep, we'll keep hammering away at that. But you know what else is an injustice? I saw this earlier this week, and I didn't know whether this was an injustice or not, but it was a fascinating story. I was reading about Jeff Goldblum, you know, the actor who was in Jurassic Park and The Fly and all these other things. He's a guy who has done very well in his acting career. In other words, he has made a lot of money over the course of his acting career. But this week he said, yeah, you know what? I was late to this whole fatherhood thing. I had my kids later in life. Doesn't matter. My kids are not getting my money when I die. I'm going to give it away to charities and other things. They can row their own boat, I think is what the line that he used. What do you think about that idea of parents, wow, wealthy or not, telling their kids, you know what? I want you to have to figure your own way to be a productive member of society and you're not getting my money. What do you think about that idea?
Well, I think it certainly lights a fire, doesn't it? I think Warren Buffett has a very similar outlook on passing on his wealth as well. You know, as someone who did not inherit anything, both of my parents are gone. What I inherited was a great childhood and a great education and a great foundation in life. And they taught me how to work hard and how to be a good person. And that's all they owed me as a kid. They did not owe me a penny of their money to, after they were gone. I think there's, a lot of evidence out there that kids, young people who grow up in wealthy situations and don't have to work hard and don't have to kind of pay their dues, quite honestly, don't turn out to be the best people in the world. So, I agree with Jeff. I don't think his kids are owed anything by his success in his life. As long as he's been a good dad and given a good foundation to his kids, that's what their inheritance should be.
Okay. And I agree with what you said. So fantastic. You know, I loved what you said about your parents and what they gave you. And I feel the exact same way about my parents, the stuff that I was taught and the life I was given, all that kind of stuff. I feel very blessed about that. However, I don't know, and I'm not asking you what, your parents, I don't think were Bill Gates or were, Warren Buffett, but all those things they gave you, if they had money though, and then said, you know what, Meredith? Yeah, we've given you all these great things. We've also got some money that could make your life easier, but no, we're going to give it to some charity to look after, wayward street dogs. I got to believe there's going to be a little bit of sourness about that.
Yeah, I'm sure you're absolutely right. There would have been sourness in that, for sure. And, would I have loved to have inherited, $500,000 from my parents? Absolutely. I would have loved to have done that. But I kind of see your point that, yes, I would feel maybe slighted? Is this a reflection on how much my parents love me? That kind of thing. But I'm kind of guessing that Jeff and Warren Buffett and some other folks who, you know, who have done well financially in life, when they take that approach, I believe they're doing it out of, you know, a sense of being the best parent they can be. And, you know, it's not, oh, you know, I don't like my kids and I don't want them to be successful and, you know, have a nice life. It's more that, you know, you really learn how to get through life by making your way in it. And
Yeah, one of the things that is unclear in the story, and I wish they had asked a follow-up question, you would have, as a national newspaper award-winning or journalist, you would have asked the follow-up question is, when you say you're not leaving them your money, do you mean no money or not all of your money? Because that's another difference too. If you're Warren Buffett, for example, and you've got $120 billion, I don't know that your kids have to expect they're going to get $120 billion when you kick. But at the same time, I don't know that it's unreasonable to say, but I'm going to leave you $5 million to make sure that you have a, you know, an okay life and you're looked after. Like, there's a difference between none and all.
Yes, absolutely. And, you know, where that number falls in the middle,
I don't know.
You know, yeah, exactly. We don't know, but you're absolutely right. There's, you know, a vast difference between you're not getting a penny and, hey, you're getting a bit, but you're not getting it all.
Because, you know, I think a lot of people would say nobody needs $120 billion. I would say that Warren Buffett probably says, I don't need $120 billion. I mean, I think he likes making money. But, you know, a lot of these people, I don't think, for all the criticism that some people have of Jeff Bezos or all these people, I don't think most of them think they need this amount of money. They just happen to have it and like having it. And so they're saying, yeah, but nobody is good. You know, I give it to my kids when I'm dead. They didn't make it. They didn't earn it. I'm going to have a bunch of kids that are going out spending $1 billion a year on stupid stuff. And, you know, I mean, honestly, and I, you know what? I bet there would be some kids that would do that.
Yeah. Yeah.
You give me $1 billion, Meredith. And look, I like to believe I'm somewhat level-headed. I think I would have a hard time keeping all that money in the bank if I suddenly was given $1 billion, let alone $100 billion.
I would like to really find that out, though, what kind of billionaire I would be.
You'd be willing to take that risk?
Let's just make this an experiment. Yes.
Explore that lifestyle. All right. Well, anyone who's got $1 billion and wants to give it to one of Hamilton's national newspaper award-winning writers, you know where to find Meredith. Meredith, we have been, I think most people have been watching with interest what's been going on south of the border at university campuses, Columbia and New York and UCLA and a bunch of others, and now starting to trickle up this way at McGill and U of T this week, started to see some protests and encampments. Concordia is having this as well. Have university students with this particular issue, have they lost the narrative here, or is this just the 1960 human rights, civil rights protests all over again in a different format?
Yeah, I kind of, it's the latter, really. You know, I mean, yeah, it was, you know, the 1960s and civil rights and the women's movement and anti-Vietnam War and all of that kind of boiled through the 60s and into the 70s. And then, you know, in the 1980s, we had, you know, anti-apartheid protests and that kind of thing. And, you know, the 90s, you know, students were out protesting Nike or, you know, Adidas or sweatshop labor, that kind of thing. And, you know, and then most recently, you know, climate change protests, Black Lives Matter protests. I think, you know, I think it's, you know, it's kind of, in a way, part and parcel of the university experience, right? You're embroiled in kind of this newfound independence, this newfound kind of, you know, discussions of ideas. And, you know, today's faculty members were probably yesterday's protesters. It's just kind of embedded in the university experience. You know, when I was in university, that was when Nina Devilliers was killed. And you know, there was this feeling, you know, and after that, the Ecole Polytechnique massacre, and there was really this feeling, you know, among young women at that time that we weren't safe, and you know, the world, you know, wasn't taking the lives of young women seriously enough. And you know, of course, that's carrying on today with the murdered and missing Indigenous women. And so, you know, I remember going to protests about that, the Take Back the Night protests, and it was incredibly invigorating. And you know, this sense that you had a voice and you could be part of a social change, whether that actually resulted is a big matter of discussion, but the feeling of being part of that moment and having your voice be heard. And you know, I really feel for young people today. You know, it's a tough world. They've got a lot, you know, they've got climate change and war and economic uncertainty, and just, you know, where are we going as a people? You know, human rights, we seem to see human rights being, you know, slid back in really scary ways. And so, you know, I don't blame these students.
Meredith, where I would blame the students, if we're going to say that, right, is what, back in the civil rights protests of the 60s. Now, that was before my time, and so someone who's listening may say, no, you've got this all wrong, you missed it. But the civil rights protests of the 60s, they didn't, I don't recall anyway from history, go into universities and intentionally damage them and vandalize them. And like there was protests, and but it seems to me like the students now, what's happening in Columbia and at UCLA over the last couple of days, where, you know, they've gone in, we're seeing reports and video where they've gone into these libraries and these buildings that they've occupied. And the point is to do as much damage as possible. And I'm looking going, how is that making your case? How is that helping anyone who in Palestine or Gaza, if that's what your case is about, how is that doing anything other than making everybody who disagrees with you look at you like a spoiled child who comes from rich families because you're at one of these Ivy League schools, and you are simply being a petulant child? To me, a protest is a protest.
Right.
But when it gets into how much damage can we do, even Al Sharpton, I mean, look, there's nobody more left-wing than Al Sharpton. Even he said on Thursday, you know what, these protests, these kids, these students who are doing this, have lost the moral high ground, and now it's no different than January 6th. That's a stunning statement from a guy who's that far on the left.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I guess, you know, it's being so far removed from it, and you know, you and I are both of the media, so you know, we kind of understand how things work. You know, it's hard to know how much does those, you know, those, that vandalism and kind of the thuggery aspect of it all, how much does that reflect the entire protest? Is it, you know, 5% of the students taking part in that, or is it 65%?
And is it even students, Meredith? Is it even students? There are suggestions there are like people hired to come in and be agitators, which, you know, who knows? Who knows what's going on exactly with it now? But yeah, it certainly isn't a great look, whether that's students or otherwise.
Right. No, it's not. And you know, the protests need to stay, you know, peaceful and on point. And you know, property damage, it isn't a good look. But at the same time, you know, sometimes, you know, we look back, you know, with a vision of history, and you know, some protests turned violent in a way that never should have happened through, you know, security forces, police forces,
Kent
those
State.
Kinds of things.
Yep.
Kent State is the poster child for that. So, you know, I worry on both sides, right? I worry that the whole point of this protest gets lost in the shuffle of discussion around, you know, property damage and how much enforcement is too much enforcement. And I worry, you know, for the safety of students who I'm going to guess the vast majority of them are there, you know, because they want to be a part of this moment in history. They want to have their voices be heard. You know, the vast majority of them are not going to be there to, you know, to cause damage.
We only have a couple seconds, but let me just ask one more thing. If you are at a protest and you see someone saying something terribly anti-Semitic or blocking a Jewish student from crossing a line or doing something, do you have a responsibility to say, I can't be part of this protest anymore? I can't stand here and be associated with people who would be anti-Semitic or anything else? Because that's where I also see high ground being lost, that people seeing this stuff happening and not doing anything.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, you can have your interpretation of what's happening in Gaza and the state of Israel and all the rest of it. As soon as we get into anti-Semitic behavior or the idea that a Jewish person wouldn't be allowed to be part of this debate or, you know, have their voice be heard, I mean, you've crossed a line and you are no better than what you are asking, you know, people to side with you for. I agree with you that you have then lost the moral high ground in what you are discussing, because you are better than your enemy at that point.
We got to go. But I have found it a little ironic this week that those who are protesting against an occupation are protesting by occupying a school, which seems like it's a little bit of irony that is being lost on some of them. Anyway, Meredith, there was a strange story this week that I was reading about, came out on Thursday, that unions representing public servants, federal public servants, are outraged because the disaster, another one of their words, that the federal government now says that public service workers who work for the federal government are going to have to be in the office at least 3 days a week now. And is it really an outrage to ask that your employees, if they work for a government, that they be in the office a little more than half the time? Is that outrageous?
No, it's not outrageous. And so my understanding is that the previous kind of policy or agreement, I guess, between the public sector union and the government was it was either 2 or 3 days in the office a week. So this is obviously since, you know, pandemic restrictions were lifted and kind of things have returned to normal. So what they're asking for is, you know, a cemented in third day, right? So it's not like we're going from, hey, you never have to come into the office, to, hey, you have to come in 3 days a week, right? So, it's an incremental step. Really, the fact of the matter is, you know, it is within an employer's rights to kind of, set parameters around expectations in that regard. You know, as a taxpayer, my gut surface reaction is, hey, you're paid by the taxpayers, you know, get in the office. Where I kind of question, though, is I didn't see, and maybe this is just in the reporting that I saw, and I missed it somewhere else, but I didn't see where the argument was made or the case was made that productivity has been a problem under the work from home scenario, right? And full disclosure, I am now 100% work from home. I'm self-employed. I 100% work from home and I love it. When you work for yourself, you better be productive. You know, when you work for someone else, productivity is what you bring to the table, right? That's why the employer pays you. You do something and they pay you for it.
And to that point, though, I think that there are probably federal employees who do a terrific job and are highly productive. But it seems to me that as soon as you get into public sector areas, things get muddy, and the people who aren't productive, it becomes very difficult to say, okay, Bob, you're great, so you get to be home 4 days a week, but Sally, you're kind of, you know, wetting the bed, so we need you in here. That just becomes, it's way easier just to say, look, This way we don't have fights with everybody. We don't have to go and individually, everybody's in the office. And I'm sure that's what this is about, is just, yeah, there's some people who are doing a great job, but we got to deal with the others.
Yeah. Yeah. No, you're probably absolutely right about that. You know, it's really interesting. I mean, you know, certain people thrive working from home, certain people thrive in the office, and lots of people thrive in a hybrid, right? And so the government isn't saying, at least not yet, everybody's 100% back to work. You're coming in 5 days a week. They're saying we want a hybrid, you know, carry on with a hybrid situation, but it's going to be, you know, 3 days in the office and 2 days home. There's lots of benefits around work from home, right? There's less congestion on the road. You know, work-life balance is good. You know, all those kinds of things. But there's also benefits to being in the office, right? You know, collaboration, you know, bringing up young people through the ranks, you know, a lot easier to do that in person than it is over Zoom. And also the economic benefit. I mean, you know, Doug Ford, you know, was talking about kind of downtown Ottawa and what it's like when, you know, more and more of the federal workers were working from home. It has a, you know, it has a ripple effect on our kind of downtowns as well. So
it has a huge effect. It has. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. So, you know, it's a nuanced discussion, but I think you're right. In a unionized environment, there's not a lot of room for nuance, right?
In those kind of environments where everything is a battle, like if you were to say, and this would never be the case, you are a national newspaper award-winning journalist, but if someone said, Meredith, you know, they had a meeting and said, Meredith isn't really, well, no, I'll do it to me. Scott's not really pulling his weight. Meredith is doing a great job. They tell you, you can stay at home. I may make a big stink about this and say, yeah, but what about Meredith? Now it's paperwork. Right. Now it's going through processes and hearings.
Grievances
and all the rest. Just far easier, less cumbersome to just say, okay, everybody's going to be in here 3 days a week. You can still be at home twice. Executives have to be in four. Frankly, they should be in five if I had my way. They're getting public service executives are not being paid poorly. That's, you know, they can get in. But no, I just, the stunning thing to me was the wording that was used. This is a disaster. We are outraged. You know what? I would offer public service employees the opportunity to work at home 5 days a week in exchange for a cut in their very generous pay that taxpayers are paying. Every day you want to stay at home, we'll cut 5% off your pay. You can stay at home 5 days. That's 25% less. We're good. You stay at home. I'm all for that. But I don't think anyone would take that.
Probably not. No. Although, you know, like it's not cheap to drive a car these days. I think we're all realizing that. So maybe the math actually works out. Who knows?
I would love to see that offer. And you know what? We got to run. Some people would take that. And maybe not at 5%. Maybe if you stay home 5 days a week, it's 2%. So it's 2% per day. So it's 10% less you're going to be paid. Mm-hmm. I think taxpayers might be happy with thousands of people taking that. And I think maybe some of these employees would say, I save more than 10% because of what you just described. You never know. But once again, we get into complications, and I'm not sure that governments are great at bureaucracies are great at nuance and complications. Anyway, Meredith, I want to take a couple seconds here because one of the things about Hamilton, we have a history in this city of having some great local magazines. For whatever reason, over the years, they've been around for a long time, and then one leaves and one comes back. For those who haven't seen it, and I don't know who that would be, but tell us about Hamilton City Magazine.
Well, I would love to tell you about Hamilton City Magazine. We launched in September of 2022. That was our first issue. So we are about to send the pages to the printing company for our ninth print issue. So that's exciting. Number 10 will be a milestone for sure. So we are locally owned, locally independent media voice. You know, the former Hamilton magazine, which was a great magazine around for about 40 years or so, when it folded, a few of us kind of coalesced around, you know, that wasn't a great time to lose a city magazine. Hamilton's growing, it's dynamic, it's interesting, it's transitioning. And it just seemed like a really rotten time to lose an urban magazine. So we just kind of, after, lots of hand wringing and, that kind of thing, we decided, well, why don't we give it a go? And so we did.
And I think, and I know you had mentioned this the other day, that one of the things that is difficult is that it sounds like one of the things you're teaching people is that Hamilton City Magazine and Hamilton Magazine are not the same. Is that a constant learning curve? That
it's
not the same thing.
Yes. It's a constant learning curve. I get it all the time. Oh, I've read your magazine for years. And I'm like, well, maybe a year and a half, but it hasn't been years. I get it. I get the confusion. Hamilton Magazine delivered through, just like we do, we deliver free copies of our magazine through Canada Post, and then we have a subscriber list as well. But Hamilton Magazine had a very same model, and it just, it has been gone since 2019. Post Media owned it, and they, suddenly, really suddenly dropped the axe on it. And, that is the danger of having, our media owned by companies that really have no connection to Hamilton in any kind of real way. So, they can just kind of swoop in and, care about the shareholders and cut the legs out from under a publication. And so, it's a tough grind. It's a lot of work. Full disclosure, we haven't made a dime. We are just breaking even now, thanks to some wonderful advertisers who jumped on board with us really quickly, like Theater Aquarius and the Art Gallery of Hamilton. And I don't want to miss anybody, so I won't give an exhaustive list, but who saw value in what we're doing. We're trying to create some partnerships in this city. It's, as well as I do, Scott, you're a newspaper guy. It's hard. Print is hard.
What is the value, Meredith? I mean, and that's not being a ridiculous, cheeky question.
Right.
What is the value of a local magazine?
Well, I think, I think it comes in a lot of ways. I mean, we're getting people telling us, I think the greatest compliment I had was from a guy I know, and I don't know his wife, but he told me that his wife really reluctantly moved to Hamilton. And they came because of his job and that kind of thing. And she was not thrilled about it. And Hamilton City Magazine is helping her fall in love with Hamilton. And I can't think of a better compliment than that. Fall in love with your city, understand your city, appreciate your city, see your city for, its beauty and its warts. We really try to, we support local freelancers. So, all our content creators are local, and we pay them as best we can. And I hope as our business case improves, so will our, freelance rates. But I really think that, there's a lot of people coming to our city, moving here from Toronto and elsewhere, who don't know this city. And, those of us born and raised or who have been here a long time may take for granted how much we know about our city. And when you move to a new place and you don't know, some of the great places to eat, or, some of the amazing local theater we have. I mentioned Theater Aquarius, but we are blessed with some incredible local theater, from Dundas to Waterdown to Bimbrook to the Players Guild to Hamilton Theater Inc. We've got great music ensembles here in Hamilton. The HPO, obviously, Symphonia Ancaster. There's concert bands that we have. Pop music, rock music, blues music, country music, you name it, hip hop. We really are blessed as a city. And that's not even getting into the food. I mean, we talk about the food all the time.
We'll save the food for later because I'm getting hungry just thinking about it. Go look it up. Hamilton City Magazine. If you're not familiar with it, go and find it. It is worth your time.
You're listening to the Scott Radley Show podcast on 900 CHML.
One of the interesting things that could happen tonight, later tonight, even as we're talking, the Toronto Rock are playing a playoff game in the National Lacrosse League against the Buffalo Bandits, their longtime rival, who they always have a hard time with. And the reason I bring that up is not necessarily because everyone's a lacrosse fan, although if you have not checked out the Toronto Rock, that's a pretty good show. But if the Rock happen to lose tonight and then lose Sunday in Buffalo, that means that tonight is the last event at First Ontario Centre before it is basically disassembled and put back together. When it opens again, we're told in 12 to 14 months. So I'll probably guess on the longer version of that. Most builds tend to be. But when it opens again, it will, we are told, look almost nothing like the First Ontario Centre that for the last 39 years we've grown to know. And, you know, Meredith, this is a good thing, I think, that this is going to be rebuilt. It's probably due for a freshening, and it's probably good that we're going to have a spanking new-ish arena in town. I think there will be some people, though, that will have some, I don't know if the word is sadness, at the old being gone, because I don't know that there is a place in this city that is more of a focal point for this town. In other words, I don't know that there is another place in this city that more people have been to and that have had a memory or two or 50 at. Can you think of one?
The only close thing would be Tim Hortons Field. I mean, that's the only possible, but I think you're probably right. I think probably more people will have gone through either the former Cops Coliseum or First Ontario Center over the years than, there was a lot of sadness around, you know, losing, you know, the former Ivor Wynn and, you know, but I don't think anyone out there now would say, oh, they shouldn't have touched Ivor Wynn, you know, compared to Tim Hortons Field. Mm. It's, you know, it's always, you know, we're always as human beings, especially as we get older, attached, you know, in a way to times of nostalgia, right? So sure. You'll remember your first concert, you know, down at Cops or what have you, or your, you know, your first ice skate or, you know, whatever it is, you know, a Bulldogs game, whatever it's been over the years.
Because that's the thing you just pointed out, that Ivor Wynn Stadium for sure was a centerpiece, but most of the things that people went to at Ivor Wynn were football games. And if you were not a football fan, you knew of Ivor Wynn, but you may never have set foot in there. Sure. Whereas with First Ontario Center, Cops Coliseum, it's concerts, it's sports, it's monster truck rallies, it's rodeo, it's Billy Graham Crusades, it's whatever. Yeah. I mean, there literally has been everything in there. And I find it hard to believe that if you've lived in this city for any real period of time, you haven't set foot in that building at one time or another for something.
Yeah. You know, unless you're totally opposed to crowds, but yes, I totally agree with you. Yeah. Like, you know, I would think virtually every Hamiltonian has some sort of memory, of being in that arena. But, you know, I'm really excited about what's to come. Mm. I think the vision there, you know, what I've seen of the renderings, and that kind of thing, there'll be a much stronger connection to the street. You know, some of the kind of unused or underused space inside will be better put to use. You know, I'm very, you know, hopeful that what happens there means we will, you know, continue to sort of attract the big artists, you know.
And that's a great word. That's a great word you used, hopeful, because there's been a lot of, you know, I think that Oakview Group that is behind this, Tim Lywicki, who was the president of Maple Leaf Sports Entertainment and, you know, big deal. I think that they've got a track record, but there's been enough promises over the years that I think hopeful is the proper word for this. People are saying, oh, please let this turn out.
Yeah. Well, I, you know, and I think it's fair to say that Hamilton has suffered its share of disappointments on a number of levels where big ideas have fallen through. But I fully agree with you. I mean, the Oakview Group has an incredible track record of both you know, building sports and entertainment facilities, but also managing them and operating them. And you know, I really do believe that you know, they see a great deal of potential out of Hamilton as a market that sort of supports Hamilton, or sorry, supports Toronto, but stands on its own as well, right? And I really you know, I'm excited. I'm excited to see that you know, kind of magnet for the city rejuvenated. Kind of more development around that area, more connection to the street, more reason to be in kind of in that facility when it's on dark nights, you know, like the restaurants will still be open and that kind of thing. I think that's a really important step.
And again,
And
hopeful. I mean, all those things we hope are going to spin off of this renovation because that would be the ideal. Do you remember what your first time in there was for?
Oh, holy smokes.
While you think of it, I'll tell you mine because this is, I still have the t-shirt at home. When I was in university, I think I was in university. The band Boston came to Hamilton to Cops Coliseum. The place had been open for about 3 years, and I came with a buddy, and we had tickets, 10th row seats. I remember exactly, and loved Boston, and it was amazing. And left there thinking, this is a great arena. And I still, as I say, my wife, to my wife's endless chagrin, I still have the t-shirt in a drawer. It is thin now as parchment paper. If I tried to put it on, it would evaporate. If I got it wet, it would just disappear entirely. But I've got that because to me, especially now as someone who at that time, I did not know that Hamilton was going to be home for myself and my kids and my career. But now that I still had the shirt, now I can't get rid of it. Because that to me was the,
No.
as I say, first time in the city that eventually became home. But
Yeah.
that's what Cops Coliseum, when I think of Hamilton, my first impression, other than the smokestacks, which quite honestly weren't the greatest impression when I was first
Right.
experiencing the city, my first next impression, 1A in the impression list, was Cops Coliseum. And that was a good one.
Absolutely. Yeah. You know, and that's what that it is a magnet for the city. You know, people come in for shows and go back out, and we need to make sure that, you know, we're making the best possible impression we can make. Maybe they come again for a different reason. Maybe they discover a great restaurant that they want to come to again. Whatever it is that draws them, you know, James Street North, whatever it is that draws them back. I my first concert there was John Mellencamp,
Okay. All right. That's a
like
good one.
in the 80s.
Yeah, that's a good one. That would have been
I
right
was in.
around the Paper and Fire,
Yeah,
Cherry
I was
Jubilee. What?
exactly.
Not
Oh
Cherry
God.
Jubilee.
Oh gosh, what was it called? I'm
The Cherry
terrible
Club
with.
Cherry Bomb, but it was the Lonesome Jubilee album.
Yeah.
Yeah, not
Yes.
Cherry Jubilee. That's a dessert. I got
That's a
the.
dessert with a
Yeah.
flame and some alcohol.
Yeah.
Yeah, John. I saw John Mellencamp. I saw Depeche Mode there. I've seen Bruce Springsteen there. The Chicks. I've seen a lot of concerts at Cops. Garth Brooks. I've seen a lot of concerts at Cops. And there's something really thrilling about A, not having to go to Toronto, but B, you know, being in my city and that kind of energy that's downtown when that place is hopping. I mean, there's nothing quite like it. It's pretty great. I saw Cher there. How did I forget Cher?
We'll get to Cher later in the show. We're going to talk about Cher. It's one of the questions that a lot of people have had about this renovation and everything going along with it is the belief, and I think it's a reasonable thing to say that, you know, this is a great piece of the puzzle, but if the downtown doesn't change a little bit as well or a lot, it's going to be a diamond in a field of, you know, not always nice things. How much do you think the downtown needs to, that area, when I say downtown, I mean that area immediately surrounding First Ontario Centre has to change to make this thing work. To have, as you describe, people come from Toronto, Niagara, London, Kitchener, wherever, come and look at the city and go, oh, I want to come back again. That's a terrific place.
To me, it all comes down to people living downtown. It really does. And I'm excited by the pro, and I live just on the east side of the downtown, so I could walk to Cops in, let's say, 20 minutes, right? Something like that. Sorry, not Cops, First Ontario Centre. You took me back to the 80s, and now
You
I'm
know what?
calling it Cops
Half the
again.
people in this city still call it cop, so they know exactly what you're talking about.
Yeah,
Just
exactly.
like it's the Sky Dome.
That's a perfect analogy. So I really, we need more people downtown, living downtown. We need a downtown that's still alive after 6 p.m. With commerce and good things happening on the street. So to me, that's really the essence of it all. Scott, I tell this story all the time. When I first came to the Spectator in 2003, I was kind of a general assignment reporter, and I felt like I was getting sent to, this place is closing down. There's jobs lost being lost here. There's, a spike in crime there. I was sent to crack houses and all kinds of nuts things, right? And by the time I left, I left in 2015, that tide had really turned. And, that's not to say I am not Pollyanna about our downtown. I know that there are significant problems. There is a lot of need. There is a lot, the homeless crisis is at epic proportions, the drug addiction, crisis, the mental health crisis. But I do believe that there are a lot of people. There were pioneers back in the day, who were investing money and seeing potential and the bones of Hamilton and the great streetscapes we have and the great historic architecture and all that kind of stuff. But now those pioneers, it's a flood rather than a trickle. There's a lot of investment happening. You see the cranes. I remember writing a story about the first crane that was erected in down, in the lower city in 25 years. I wrote that story for the Spectator. And now, you kind of look in any direction and you're going to see cranes and investment and building. And with all of that comes more people. It comes with more restaurants opening, more independent shops downtown. I love, one thing I really love about our downtown is it's not been taken over by chains. It's still a place of independent restaurants and independent shops and bookstores and record shops and Dr. Diss on Wilson and all of those places that really add to the character of a downtown, right? Because it's a place you're not going to find anywhere else but downtown Hamilton. And I love that. And that's what I love when I travel. I want to go to those independent places. I don't want to see the chain, whatever it is that I can, see at home. I want to see what's unique to this city. And so Hamilton has that in spades, in my opinion. There's a lot of work to be done. There's no getting around that. And we're all seeing it more and more. We have a crisis on our hands in terms of homelessness and affordable housing, and that I really hope all our levels of government start to treat like the crisis that it is, because we, unless we treat it like an emergency situation, we'll be still talking about this.
Yeah,
If you
that's.
still have your radio show 10 years from now, we'll be talking about it, right?
Yeah, no, I think you're right. Not about the radio show. They'll get rid of me long before then. But I was thinking today, because I wrote a piece for the paper that's in tomorrow, and about First Ontario, about cops, and how this tonight could depending on what happens, we'll be off the air by the time the game is decided. But what, depending on what happens, that this could be the last event at this thing. And I was trying to think of what would be the biggest thing that happened there. Now, this is a tough one because you've got, I mean, some of the ones that were coming to mind, obviously Gretzky to Lemieux in the 1987 Canada Cup. That's, yes. That's got to be up there as one of the top two or three. But you had, you know, Ben Johnson coming back from his drug ban in 1991, running in the spec indoor games. Place was jammed. It was a stormy, blizzardy night. Place was jammed to watch Ben Johnson. There have been concerts there, as you say, that, I mean, U2 played there, Billy Joel, and I mean, like, mm-hmm. go down the list. I can't think of anything that tops the Canada Cup, but I bet you for different people, because not everyone's a sports fan, there it would be a different list. It'd be a fascinating poll to take, to leave it open and say what were the top three things that happened at that arena in its current form, because I bet you would get a very varied list.
Yes, you would. Yeah, no, I think that's a great question. And of course, for years and years, the Around the Bay Road Race ended there,
right?
And
absolutely,
you know, such an iconic part of Hamilton sports history. So, yeah, I mean, you know, we're blessed to be talking about all of that, right? And I fully believe that, you know, when our new arena opens downtown and what it brings to the city, we'll be talking about epic moments for a
You're
long,
right.
long time.
You're right. And you know, there's at least one person listening. I don't know who they are. I'm just guessing. There's at least one person listening when I said, what was the best event you ever saw there? One person at least would put a check mark beside lingerie football.
Oh my gosh. How did I forget about lingerie football?
Yeah, you know, it is a sporting event. It's not an ogling activity. It's a real sporting event. At least that's what we were told. And so were the people who were there convincing themselves. You mentioned a name who happened to be in the news this week, that you, someone you had seen there on one of her, I believe, 17 farewell tours. That would be Cher, who she has had more farewell tours than I don't know, most bands have had shows.
That's true.
So this is the story, though, that I saw this week, and I thought, okay, you know what? I'm going to go here, even though some talk show hosts would say, nuh-uh, I'm not going there. We're doing it.
Okay.
Cher is now 77 years old, which is quite, you know, I don't know. Cher, to me, maybe because of all the plastic surgery, but she always seems far younger than 77 years old. That surprises me that she's that age. Her boyfriend right now is 37.
Mm-hmm.
And relative to many of the boyfriends she's had since old Sonny left us, he's kind of an adult. There have been a lot of very young men along the way. And you know what? Cher is Cher. She's, you know, but the reason that she says that she dates all these young guys is they're the only ones left. So, you know, I guess all the people her age, she suggests, are dead, or, you know, I don't know when she says the only ones left.
Right.
All right. So I'm not even going to ask you if they're the only ones left. If there are no 77-year-old single men alive on planet Earth, we know that's not the case. But whether it's a share with a 37-year-old or some old rich billionaire guy with his 25-year-old girlfriend, who they all seem to look the same, no matter who the billionaire is. Is this like, hey, you know what? Live your best life. All good. I'm happy for you. Or are you looking at this like it's a little creepy?
You know, I'm not. So I'm not creeped out by, you know, Cher with a 37-year-old. I mean, he's, you know, he's nearing middle age, this man. It's just, you know, there's a big gap, you know, between Cher and him, right?
But he's not 21.
But he's not 21. And he's not, he's going into this with eyes wide open, I'm guessing. I'm guessing there's not a lot of 77-year-old men out there who could keep up with Cher, to be frank, right?
Probably. That's probably fair.
You know, like, I, you know, in this case, I say go, girl. Like, you know, whatever makes you happy, go for it. You know, two consenting adults, good for you. I mean, I gotta think that, the life of a celebrity such as Cher, who's, just iconic, right, has kind of be a bit of a lonely one, and if in a lot of ways, right? Like, you'd always be suspicious about somebody's motives for liking you or wanting to spend time with you or what have you. And, if she's found a connection with this guy, good on her. I'm thrilled for her. Am I creeped out by the 85-year-old billionaire with the 21-year-old girl? Absolutely. I'm creeped out by that.
And, I don't know if it's like, I don't think it's sexist either way, because we're talking about both. I am definitely creeped out by those wrinkly old guys, not to drop too many names, but back in the day when Anna Nicole Smith was dating that guy who was like in his sarcophagus already, it was like, I mean, okay, I get it. He's got $1 billion and thing, and when you say motives, And about a celebrity and you're wondering about their motives, I almost wonder if at a certain point with some celebrities, whether it's Cher or these billionaires or whatever, if they just assume, I know they're after me for my money. And so if that's the case, forget it. I'm going to go for the hottest one I can possibly get and just understand what I'm getting myself into. I almost wonder, because there's no way these guys, especially the guys who are so brilliant, to be able to make themselves into billionaires, cannot see this.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. And again, I would be more than willing to, have that $1 billion and then figure out what, how I would want to spend my time with, finding somebody out there for me. It would be.
One good long shower, you could probably move ahead with your life.
Exactly.
In rubbing alcohol. Yeah. Yeah, I don't know. The whole thing, it just, when I saw this. Now you're right. I was feeling more creepy about Cher too, until you point out he is 37. Like, he's not a child.
Right.
Some of other celebrity females who we won't name, but it rhymes with blah blah blah. Some of their boyfriends have been a little bit on the younger side, and it gets into that I'm not sure category, but yeah, okay.
Yeah. I don't know how much you have in common with somebody who's that much younger than you.
Nothing.
Like, you've literally lived in different historical times.
Yes.
Like, I want somebody who remembers the 80s. Thank you very much. Yeah. I want somebody who's had similar life experiences and is in a similar time of life, and may look at the world kind of in a similar way to me. But to each his own, as they say, right?
Well, you just know that at some point Cher is like, well, back when I was on TV, and the guy goes, you were on TV? Yeah, with a guy named Sonny. Was he your son? No. The whole different story. It's not exactly the same. You're right. There are conversations that, obviously different scenario, but I have adult children. There are conversations I have with my children about things in my wife and our childhood or teenage years. They can't possibly get it because it's a different world. And so that's just with your children. If you're sitting down having dinner every night or whatever, and their frame of reference of the greatest TV show of all time is Big Bang Theory, because that's how old they are, and they've never seen Seinfeld, or even they've never seen a black and white TV, it becomes, I get it. She's 77, she's got millions of dollars, she can do what she wants.
That's right.
And, continue to do her farewell tours. I'm sure there's another one coming up. She did a farewell tour, as you say, Cops Coliseum. It was a farewell tour, by the way. I just looked it up. So,
really? Okay.
One of her more recent ones, even.
Nobody believed it. Nobody believed it. Goodbye. Yeah.
She'll do another farewell tour with The Who, and then we'll believe it, because eventually they're all just going to die off and there won't be anyone left to do it. But as I said off the top of the show, and I was, I was not teasing, I was selling her as a legitimate, it was a thing, because she is a winner of a National Newspaper Award and a 3-time nominee, which is a big, big deal. And we're having a little fun at the beginning, but Meredith, I want to bring that up again, and I'll tell you why, because I was reading a really interesting piece online, and I've heard about this before, but I want to get your thoughts on this. The headline was, "How Being an Activist Makes Me a Better Journalist." Now, I'll tell you why I'm bringing this up, because there are lots of people who are not necessarily in journalism who say, I want journalism to be objective. I want to not have everything be unbalanced. I want not everything to have a, you know, there are columnists and there are reporters. The argument here, and I found numerous stories online of a similar point, saying, you know what, being an activist is a good thing in modern journalism because objectivity is impossible. So you may as well embrace it and try and make the world a better place. What do you think about the idea of activism journalism?
Well, so I read the piece that you were talking about, and you know, there were some points I agreed with her on, right? Like, you know, yes, I mean, going back to, you know, kind of the earliest days of journalism, it was about activism and you know, trying to change the world, and you know, Nellie Bly and all those kinds of folks, and you know, one, I do believe that at their root, many, many journalists believe that powerful storytelling, shining a light on things that people need to know and understand about their communities and their world, changes things for the better. It's a good thing, right? Journalism, the actual craft of doing journalism, to me, it's not about just the status quo. It's not about everything's great in the world and let's just keep it that way. It's about, you know, finding ways that we can make people's lives better. We can, you know, oppress the oppressor and, you know, comfort the afflicted and all of that, right? So at its core, I kind of see her point in the sense that journalists need to be, you know, passionate citizens of our world. Where I disagreed with her wholeheartedly is what she said was, journalists have long claimed total objectivity. I have never in my life met a journalist who said they are completely objective. It is an impossible standard to fall to, right?
Like they strive. Yeah, you strive for objectivity.
For objectivity. We never get there. It's like a professional golfer saying they have the perfect swing. It does not exist. It's the pursuit of getting it right, right? Now, to me, the difference between an activist and a journalist who sees the power of their work to improve lives and make things better is an activist already has a fully formed perspective. They can't be swayed. They, you know, they see the world in the way they see the world. And that's great. We need activists in this world. There's no getting around that. A journalist strives for that objectivity where even those they disagree with fundamentally, their role is to fully and accurately depict what that person believes and why they believe it, right? Whereas an activist is just about the pursuit of their own opinion or their own perspective on the world at any cost. A journalist doesn't see the world that way, right?
Well, let's use an example, because I think you make a very valid point. I think you've explained it very well, no surprise. But there could be two activists, one who is entirely a pro-police activist, one who is entirely defund the police activist, and you now go as a journalist to cover an incident in which a police shot someone. Well, there are plenty of police shootings where the shooting is warranted based on the actions that have happened leading up to that. But if you are the activist who disagrees with the police and wants to defund them, you will never, I don't believe, bring yourself to acknowledge that that cop made the right decision. And on the flip side, if the cop made a bad decision and did a bad job and had a bad shooting, those who are only in favor of police under all circumstances would never acknowledge that it was a bad choice and that something bad happened. And to me, that's the problem. And that's just one example. You can pick anyone you want, but that's the problem. If you're a journalist and you go to a scene and they give you an explanation and you won't believe it because there has to be a conclusion that you've arrived with before you start.
Right.
That can't be journalism.
No, that's not journalism. That's the antithesis of journalism, right? A journalist needs to arrive at whatever it is, whatever the issue is, whatever the event is, whatever, with only the pursuit of what did happen here. That's their only job, is to report what did happen here, right? It's like, it's like an activist is the debater at a debate, you know, one side or the other, and the journalist is the one covering the debate, right? Who has to, fully describe to someone who wasn't there, what did that person say? What did candidate A say versus what did candidate B say? What was the exchange of ideas there? What were the arguments about who accused who of what? Journalists have to be, it comes back to that pursuit of objectivity, right? Like, I've taught journalism for quite a number of years. And to me, when you are a reporter, and yes, a columnist is a different beast entirely. I'm talking about a news reporter.
Right.
When you are a reporter and you go to cover an event or an issue or a debate or whatever it is, whatever you're covering, I should be able to get to the bottom of that story in isolation, that story in and of itself, and not know whose side I'm on, for a simplistic way to look at it, right? Like, as a reader, I should not know where that journalist's own personal viewpoints on this issue lie, right? I should be able to get to the end of that story and believe and understand both sides, or the three sides, or whatever. I should be able to understand what the folks involved in this situation had to say about it, or how it unfolded, without the perspective of the journalist, kind of treading all over that. Right.
And
that's not the role.
And I think that, it's changed, because I think there are a lot of activist journalists on both sides, not just on one side of the political aisle, on both sides. Mm-hmm. But I think if you wonder why our politics north of the border and in Canada, in some cases, is the way it is, social media clearly is a big part of that.
Mm-hmm.
But I also think that you can point to the fact that there are some people, the interesting thing is, you can tell the great political reporters in this country because they don't do this. But there are a lot of people who show up and they've already, I believe they've already decided what their story is, regardless of what is said or done.
Mm-hmm. And I agree with you. And that's a problem. That is not good journalism. I should be able to, as a journalist, I should be able to always pursue objectivity, park my own feelings at the door, present things in a way that, fully and accurately describe everything that's unfolded. That is a really hard thing to do. Mm. And I don't think people give credit for how hard it is to do. It is a very hard thing to instill in journalism students, keeping yourself out of the story.
Yeah,
it is.
Yeah.
It's and way easier to sit down and write what you think about something than it is to write what other people think.
And sometimes write something you disagree with.
Exactly.
Yeah. That is Meredith McLeod, who has done that for her career, not just always writing what she disagrees with, but sometimes. She is the associate publisher of Hamilton City Magazine. She's also the editorial director there. She's as I've said many times, but it's worth mentioning, because if I ever won one, heaven knows I'd be mentioning it, National Newspaper Award winner. Meredith, thanks for doing this today. Really appreciate you jumping on. Fantastic job.
Oh, thanks, Scott. I enjoyed myself.
The Scott Radley Show. Weekday evenings from 6 to 8 on 900 CHML.
The Scott Radley Show podcast is available on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, and wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Scott Radley. Thanks again for listening, and do not forget to subscribe to this podcast. It is free. You will never miss an episode. And also, be sure you rate us and review us. Whatever you think of us, we'll take it. Thanks for listening.
Canada may be known for its landscapes and friendly people, but beneath the surface lies a darker side of crime, history, and the paranormal. Since 2017, the award-winning Dark Poutine podcast has explored the shadowy corners of the Great White North and beyond, delivering chilling tales from a uniquely Canadian perspective. Hosted by Mike Brown and Matthew Stockton, with over 300 episodes and fresh releases every Monday, Dark Poutine is your weekly ticket to the creepier side of Canada. Listen to Dark Poutine on Apple, Spotify, Amazon Music, or wherever you get your podcasts.